This Sandwell News podcast is divided into chapters.
Welcome to the Sandwell News for the blind and visually impaired community living in and around Sandwell. This edition due with the Elder 21st, which is of course the spring equinox. And here's the sunrise and sunset times and some brief information about the weather we might expect next week.
For the coming week, sunrise will be at just after 6 a.m. Sunset will be at 6:25 p.m. Temperatures will reach 10 degrees, with wind speed at 15 miles per hour. It should be warmer by midweek.
Yes, spring is on the way, it would seem. And my apologies, by the way, for saying this would be the final edition before Easter. In fact, there's another edition next week. Before we get to the news and other items, here's some of the activities coming up at SVI next week.
Hello SVI, members, friends and volunteers. The list of activities taking place next week. Monday 23rd March, open meeting at Portway Lifestyle Centre, 1:30 to 4 p.m. You're invited to our March open meeting. This is an important session about the future of SVI. We'll share updates on proposed funding changes and discuss what happens as Sandwell Council funding is phased out. Your views and ideas are vital in shaping what comes next. If SVI matters to you, please come along and tell us how our services impact your life. SVI is a user-led organisation, and we welcome anyone who would like to get more involved. Refreshments will be provided, and there will be a raffle. Please arrange your own transport. Travel costs will be reimbursed for Sandwell residents with a valid receipt. Tuesday, 24th March. Gym at Portway Lifestyle Centre, 10 to 12 noon. Break a sweat and boost your energy with fellow SVI members. From treadmills and bikes to weights, there's something for everyone, and plenty of support to help you along the way. It's a fun, social way to stay fit and active all year round, rain or shine. Line dancing at Dartmouth Central Club, 1 to 2:30 p.m. Put on your dancing shoes and join Ray and Jean for a lively line dancing session full of fun and feel-good moves. Whether you're looking to stay active, improve your balance, or simply meet new people, this is the perfect chance. Absolute beginners are welcome. Just come along and enjoy. We'd love to see you on the dance floor. Wednesday, 25th March. Showdown at Portway Lifestyle Centre, 1 to 3 p.m. Come and join us for this fast-moving, interactive sport that's a mix of table tennis and air hockey. It's specially designed for blind and visually impaired players. But the best part is anyone can play, and everyone has fun. Expect laughter, friendly competition, and a chance to try something a little different. Why not come along and see what it's all about? Thursday, 26th March. Easter Bunny Walk at Dartmouth Park, 12 noon. Meeting by the memorial in Dartmouth Park for a gentle, bunny-approved wander through the park and Sandwell Valley. We'll finish our Easter adventure at the Sandwell Valley Visitor Centre, where tasty refreshments will be on sale for all our little and big bunnies. Floppy ears, fluffy tails, and happy hopping highly encouraged. It is important that you contact the office either by phone, message, Facebook or email to let us know that you are attending any of our events. That's all for this week. We look forward to seeing you soon. The SVI team. Sandwell Visually Impaired. West Bromwich Town Hall. Lodge Road, West Bromwich. B708EY. Telephone 0121 525-4810. www.sandwellvisuallyimpaired.org.uk.
Some of the pieces from this week's readings from the Express and Star. Wednesday, 11th of March, dog owner banned from keeping pets. New Peaky Blinders theme pub in Tipton. Red Leaf Buffet in West Bromwich. Thursday, old leisure centre to make way for housing. Two teens held after knife recovered. Man injured in shootings in Bearwood. Rebuilding of pavilion in Wensbury. Friday, AI screening for Glockomer. Opening dates for two new rail stations. nattering with a humanoid robot. Detectives talk about prosecution of a baby's murder. Saturday, 28 room B&B in Cradley Heath approved. Ambulance hours lost waiting outside hospitals. Changes to metro tram services. Knitting and relaxation sessions at Oak House. Monday, plaque unveiled to remember the fallen in two world wars. Pet hospital opens new cardiac facility. West Bromwich MP calls for health inequality debate. Tuesday, Tory councillor joins Green Party. 10-year ban for woman to keep animals. Baggies back to winning ways. Wife killed for seeking divorce.
We would like to bring an important matter to your attention, particularly for those of you who have a guide dog or travel with a pet dog. It has been reported to us that an incident recently occurred in which a person with a dog unfortunately attacked a member's guide dog. This took place near the West Bromwich bus station area. While we understand that such incidents are uncommon, they can be very distressing and potentially dangerous for both the guide dog and its owner. Your safety and the well-being of your guide dogs are extremely important to us. If you experience any incidents or concerns while out in the community, please do let us know so that we can continue to keep members informed and aware.
Thanks to SVI for that message. And as they point out, fortunately, such incidents are rare. I'm afraid there's no understanding the mentality of some dog owners. Well, a glimpse of what's ahead. An interview I should have squeezed in last week, but was squeezed out by news items. But we will be hearing from this lady later on in this edition.
Hi, I'm Sophia, and I'm here today to talk about functional neurological disorder or functional vision disorder.
Yes, neurological visual disorder, and it's a very hard condition to diagnose. That won't be so much a factual explanation of what it is, but really one woman's experience of it. Also coming up as usual with the TV and radio listings from Talking News Federation, and I might be able to squeeze in one or two more of their items too, and the latest West Bromwich match report, which is much more good news this week. So on to the news for this week, starting with last Wednesday's paper.
Hi everyone, it's Mia. Today I'm going to be reading some newspaper articles dated from Wednesday the 11th of March, Express and Star. I hope you're all well and enjoying this somewhat better weather that we've been gifted with. You all have a lovely rest of your week. Let's begin. Man arrested over exposure. Police have asked people not to speculate or share photographs online as they continue to investigate reports of an exposure in Tipton. Police are investigating a report of an exposure on Wensbury Oak Road, Tipton, on Monday. A 72-year-old man was arrested and questioned on suspicion of outraging public decency and has been bailed with strict conditions. A West Midlands police spokesperson said, "We want to reiterate this is an active, ongoing investigation and we would urge people not to speculate or share photos online following the incident. We understand the distress this has caused to the local community, and we have stepped up patrols in the area to offer reassurance." Dog owner banned from owning animals after self-medicating pets. A Tipton man with over 10 dogs has avoided jail after self-medicating his emaciated animals with unprescribed antibiotics. Andrew Slocum, 33, from St John's Road, was forced to hand over 7 dogs to authorities after a female bulldog called Minnie died after being caused unnecessary suffering. In October 2024, RSPCA animal welfare officers found terriers, French bulldogs and lurchers in rancid conditions at Slocum's home. The emaciated animals had a variety of health complaints, which worsened due to Slocum not bothering to care for the dogs, called Duke, Minnie, Dolly and Nala, or getting veterinary care despite knowing their conditions could only get worse. Slocum pleaded guilty in January at Dudley Magistrates Court to several charges of causing unnecessary suffering to animals in October 2024 by failing to investigate the causes of weight loss, leg injuries, and poor body condition. Prosecuting for the RSPCA, Janita Patel, said, "The kennels were filthy and the smell of urine was overpowering. There was no fresh water, and due to being emaciated, female bulldog Minnie had to be euthanized." He self-medicated the dogs with unprescribed antibiotics, which leads us to believe all of the dogs in his care are in danger, as well as Duke, Dolly, Bella and Nala. Slocum had 7 dogs in his home when sentenced last week. In mitigation, the court heard Slocum suffered from depression and anxiety, requiring a career carer 7 days a week. He apologised for becoming overwhelmed by responsibility of caring for the animals. He received an 18-week sentence, which was suspended for 18 months. He was banned from owning pets for 10 years, ordered to attend 30 rehabilitation days, and pay £540 in costs. Popular pub gets new look by order of the Peaky Blinders. Arthur Shelby lookalike owner makes the Boozer a tribute to hit TV crime drama. A popular Tipton pub has undergone a dramatic change by its new owners as they pay homage to a popular TV series. The inside of the King's Arms on Toll End Road in Tipton now carries the feeling of times following the First World War after being redecorated and remodelled to look like the garrison, the Shelby family's primary Birmingham base in Peaky Blinders. The pub was the main drinking location of the characters in the popular series, and that look has been replicated by the new owners, Paul O'Riordan and Michelle Barnes, who are both members of the Proper Peakies group. Miss Barnes, who has past experience in the pub industry, said the couple had taken over the pub in October and had decided to turn it into a Peaky Blinders tribute pub due to the location and as a way of promoting the series. She said it used to be a Marston's pub with 2 rooms, a big bar and a brick look all the way through, and I'm a local girl from Tipton, whereas Paul is from Birmingham, and we've been together 9 years and decided to take it on. We've also decided to turn it into a Peaky's pub, because there used to be one on the waterfront, but it closed down, and there weren't any other local Peaky Blinders pubs or bars that you could go to. We're only 5 minutes in the car away from the Black Country Museum, so it was perfect, as there's something about the area that people love, through the way they dressed, and the atmosphere, and it's a chance for everyone to get together, have a good drink, and enjoy music. Mr. O'Riordan said, "It's about the Midlands and about celebrating Peaky Blinders, as wherever you go around here, you'll find something that reminds you of it. Unfortunately, all of the Peaky pubs have been in Birmingham, but now we've got one here in Tipton." Mr. Barnes said the pub was full of a lot of antiques and backdrops for the show, as well as props and lookalikes, including Mr. O'Riordan, who Miss Barnes said was the spitting image of Arthur Shelby. She said, "He really is the spit of him, and people walk in and almost do a triple take when they see him. They'll ask him whether he's the real guy, and Paul will say he's just a lookalike. But people really don't believe he's just a lookalike, as he's that real." As part of celebrations for the Peaky Blinders, the Immortal Man film, Miss Barnes said there would be a special screening on March 21st, and invited people to come and enjoy a traditional Black Country welcome. Restaurant reopens after a £120,000 refurb. It's a restaurant which offers a high quality range of international food, all served in a comfortable and relaxed environment. Red Leaf Global Buffet in West Bromwich High Street offers a selection of dishes from across the world, including English, European, Caribbean, Chinese, Indian, Mexican, and even Thai, as well as a carvery, vegan, and vegetarian dishes. The restaurant has been part of the culinary scene in the town since 2013, and has recently undergone a £120,000 renovation to give it a new look and update the food menu. Owner, Gabir Singh, said the aim was to offer more choice from an extended Chinese menu, along with a selection of grills. He said, "We've made some changes to the interior of the restaurant, but the main difference we've made is by having a number of live kitchens where people can pick their selection and give it to the chef, and they can cook it in front of them. We have introduced street food, and we've really increased the variety of the food, as well as providing a number of selections and premium collections." Mr. Singh said the restaurant has remained popular due to the range of food on offer, including new varieties of pizza and Chinese and Mexican cuisine, as well as the quality of the service.
Hello, this is Jan Lloyd, reading articles from the Express and Star on the 12th of March. Deteriorating leisure centre set to make way for housing, by Christian Barnett. A 125-year-old facility described as poorest in the borough could be demolished. Councillors this week were expected to give the go-ahead to demolish a deteriorating leisure centre to make way for housing. Sandwell Council has revealed it is looking to demolish the 125-year-old Harry Mitchell Leisure Centre in Smethwick as part of plans to flatten the site for housing. The local authority said the leisure centre was surplus to requirements and demolition of the building was currently expected to cost around £711,000. The council said early plans include between 30 and 45 houses and flats, but could reach as many as 80 dwellings. The Labour-run council's cabinet was meeting this week to make a decision. The council said the leisure centre was the oldest and poorest facility in the borough and would need at least £1.5 million, according to a 2018 survey, to completely refurbish and bring it to standard, including rewiring and new boilers. It would also need substantial repairs to the roof. The leisure centre closed casually in May last year and was empty by October, remaining empty since. Parts of the leisure centre relocated to the new Sandwell Aquatic Centre in 2024. Sandwell Council revealed at the start of 2025 that it was looking to give up Hadley Stadium in Smethwick and close the Harry Mitchell Leisure Centre as part of plans to save more than £500,000 through a review of its leisure facilities. This week's Cabinet report said that £540,000 of savings set out in the Council's budget last year had been met through alternative sources, but resolving the future of the site would support the Council's wider strategic view. The report said, since 2018 survey, further deterioration has occurred, including significant roof leaks and water ingress, resulting in urgent repair needs. The building is now considered to be in extremely poor cosmetic condition and requires complete refurbishment, including a new roof, boilers and rewiring. Given the escalating costs of repair, the limited scale of the facility and the availability of high-quality alternative provision in the surrounding area, retention is no longer considered financially viable. The site of Harry Mitchell Leisure Centre, next to Smethwick Cricket Club, was gifted to Smethwick Urban District Council by its namesake in 1899. Last year, Councillor Ashley Lewis, who represents the Smethwick ward, said Hadley Stadium, which sits less than a mile from the £73 million Sandwell Aquatic Centre built for the Birmingham Commonwealth Games, was once called the borough's jewel in the crown, but had been left to crumble on purpose. Councillor Lewis said the site had been in disrepair for 7 or 8 years without any investment and had managed to decline. Sandwell Council pays £4 million a year to Sandwell Leisure Trust to run the borough's facilities on its behalf, but the local authority is still responsible for repairs and maintenance under the agreement. The council's contract with Core Sandwell, the recently rebranded Sandwell Leisure Trust, ends in 2027 following an agreement by Cabinet in 2023. Teen held after knife recovered. Police arrested a teenager after police recovered a knife behind a row of shops in West Bromwich. The teenager was arrested after officers from West Midlands Police's Project Guardian carried out a stop and search after noticing suspicious activity behind a row of shops in St Michael Street. A knife was recovered and a 16-year-old boy was arrested on suspicion of possession of an offensive weapon. He has been bailed pending further inquiries. A police spokesman said Project Guardian is a specialist task force which tackles knife crime and youth violence. If you know someone who is carrying a weapon, call 101. You can also talk to us online or report anonymously to Crime Stoppers on 0800 555 111. For more information and advice to ditch the knife, visit our hashtag Life or Knife website, Home Life or Knife. Locals shocked after man injured in shooting, by James Vukramovich. Concerned residents living near a street where a man was left seriously injured after being shot in the leg have told of their shock. Emergency crews were called to Bearwood Road at around 1:30 a.m. yesterday and found a 19-year-old man with serious leg injuries. He was treated at the scene, then conveyed to hospital by an ambulance crew, while police officers cordoned off the road from Sandon Road to the junction with Rutland Road and St Mary's Road. Three men have been arrested on suspicion of violent disorder. It is the latest to happen in the area, with two major incidents in the last month alone. Three people were left with injuries following a disorder on Bearwood High Street on February the 11th, with three men arrested on suspicion of assault, while the murder of Zeshan Asfal at the Jameer Masjid Mosque on Albury Road on February the 20th has seen seven people arrested in connection. One local, who asked not to be named, said, "It's not the first time I've seen something like this happen around here. I remember a stabbing a few weeks ago. I'm not massively shocked." Another woman said, "I'm not even that surprised, as it's getting worse round here." Witnesses could call 101, quoting log 180 of March the 11th. And the photograph accompanying the article shows Bearwood High Street closed off with lots of blue and white police tape across the road and a police car actually blocking the road with green fencing around it. Spades in ground for rebuilding of pavilion, by James Vukramovich. Work has begun to provide a community hub in a black country town with a new pavilion. The Hythe Road Pavilion in Wednesbury has celebrated a major milestone with an official spade in the ground ceremony on Monday to mark the start of a rebuild. This new development forms part of the Wednesbury Levelling Up Partnership programme funded by the government. Chairman of the Wednesbury Levelling Up Partnership Board, Callie-Anne Titley, said, "The Hythe Road Pavilion is being rebuilt to better serve the growing community. The new pavilion will provide much needed space for new sports programmes, including a community space for socialising after sports." Sandwell Council's Deputy Leader and Cabinet Member for Neighbourhoods and Community Councillor Suzanne Hartwell said, "I'm pleased to see the progress of this project. It adds to other work led by the council to upgrade green spaces throughout Sandwell, as we know how important these are to local residents." The Wednesbury Levelling Up Partnership Board said the new structure would be named Patent Shaft Pavilion, a name, it said, was suggested by Wednesbury young people. And the article's accompanied by a photograph of Councillors Peter Hughes and Susan Hartwell with Partnership Board Young People's member Caitlin standing with a spade ready to dig a great swathe out of the ground.
Hiya, it's Gavin. I've got some readings for you from Friday the 13th of March. AI screening could boost detection of glaucoma, study shows. Screening for a common eye condition using artificial intelligence could slash the number of unnecessary referrals to specialists, a study has found. The technology could also boost the detection of glaucoma, as well as enabling earlier treatments and helping to prevent avoidable blindness, researchers said. Glaucoma is caused when fluid builds up in the front part of the eye, damaging the optic nerve, which connects the eye and the brain. And it is most common in people aged over 50. And while it does not usually have symptoms, it can cause blindness if left untreated. Researchers in Portugal used an AI tool that analyses images of the eye to screen people for glaucoma. The study, published in The Lancet Primary Care, included 671 people aged between 55 and 65. AI referred 66 people to specialists compared to 118 referrals made by eye doctors. Glaucoma was diagnosed in 40 patients. Researchers said the findings suggest AI screening for glaucoma in primary care can be cost-effective and can reduce unnecessary expert referrals, even though a one-off screening round might not capture every case. AI could enhance efficiency and detection, enable earlier treatment, and prevent avoidable blindness, they added. Elsewhere, the study also found that the AI tool correctly detected 78% of people who had glaucoma compared to the 75% identified by doctors. The technology also ruled out the condition in 95% of people who did not have it, compared to 91% by medics. Researchers said false positive referrals are the main drivers of unnecessary follow-up, patient anxiety, clinical workload and healthcare costs. One limitation of the study is there were a high number of patients with diabetes and that the prevalence of glaucoma should not be interpreted as representative of the general population aged between 55 and 65. They highlighted that the link between diabetes and glaucoma remains controversial and the European Glaucoma Society does not recognise diabetes as an established risk factor. The study comes after experts estimated that glaucoma cases could rise by 60% to 1.6 million in the UK by 2060. In January, researchers from UCL and Moorfields Eye Hospital also said previous estimates that suggested 700,000 people in the UK were living with glaucoma may not reflect the current population structure. Using the most recent census data, they estimated that 1.1 million people in the UK currently have the condition, the equivalent of 3% of the population over the age of 40. There is an image here of a patient taking an eye test. So they're facing the camera with the magnifying glass of in the test. And there's a caption underneath that says, experts concluded that screening with the use of AI could reduce the number of unnecessary referrals. Opening dates are announced for two new railway stations. Trains will be welcoming passengers next week for the first time since 1965. The much-anticipated opening date for two new Black Country railway stations has finally been announced. Trains will be welcoming passengers at Willenhall and Darlaston from Thursday, March 19th, for the first time since 1965. Darlaston station also includes a car park with 800 spaces for park and ride commuters, while Willenhall includes an additional 88 parking spaces. The opening of these two train stations will be followed by another three in South Birmingham on the Camp Hill line. Mosley Village, King's Heath and Pineapple Road will open on Tuesday, April 7th. It will be the first time since the Second World War that passengers will have used these stations. The five new railway stations in the West Midlands complete a £185 million project supported by significant government investment. Transport for West Midlands says they are reconnecting communities to the rail network for the first time in generations. The new stations will give residents a faster and greener alternative to the car for their journeys, reducing traffic and making it easier for people to visit town centres and support local businesses. TFWM added, final authorisation from the Office of Rail and Road is expected in the coming days, keeping the project on track to open on these dates. The five stations feature sheltered platforms, accessible lifts, ticket machines and secure cycle racks. This project has been supported by £126 million of funding from the government. Following a review of transport projects in 2024, Richard Parker, Mayor of the West Midlands, secured an additional £80 million funding to make sure the Camp Hill stations were completed. He said, "When I took office, I promised we would get these stations finished and ready for the community, and now we are delivering on that promise. Closing those stations during the last century was a short-sighted mistake which has now been put right. No longer will residents have to watch every day as trains rush past without stopping. These vital new services will not only restore a historic link between the railways and our communities, they will create a new lifeline for local people, supporting our high streets, opening up new opportunities and connections and driving economic growth." The project is led by Transport for West Midlands, part of the West Midlands Combined Authority and the West Midlands Rail Executive, in partnership with Network Rail, West Midlands Railway, Birmingham City Council, Walsall Council and the Department for Transport. Construction of the Camp Hill stations was delivered by Volker Fitzpatrick, while contractor Kia built Willenhall and Darlaston stations. Transport Secretary Heidi Alexander said, thanks to government investment, fast and frequent rail services will arrive at new stations across Birmingham and the Black Country for the first time in decades, reducing congestion and improving local transport connections. Residents enjoy a natter with humanoid robot at care home. The robot interacted with residents and answered their questions at a Black Country care home. Residents at Newbury Manor Nursing Home in Albury were given a glimpse of the future after welcoming a rare humanoid robot to their home for a special demonstration. The visit, which was featured on ITV News, saw the robot interact with residents and answer their questions as part of a trial showcasing its conversational abilities. Staff at the home said residents were fascinated by the technology, with many taking the opportunity to chat with the robot and ask how it works. The demonstration formed part of efforts to explore how robots could help tackle loneliness among older people in care settings. Care homes across the world are increasingly experimenting with social robots designed to hold simple conversations, play games, and provide companionship. Studies suggest these machines can help improve mental well-being and reduce feelings of isolation among elderly residents. During the session at Newbury Manor, residents gathered together to see the robot in action as it responded to questions and engaged in light-hearted conversation. Staff praised the residents for their curiosity and enthusiasm during the visit. In a post on social media after the ITV broadcast, the home said, "We welcomed into our home one of four humanoid robots in the world to demonstrate her conversation capabilities, and she was brilliant, as were our residents who asked questions." Newbury Manor Nursing Home provides residential and nursing care and aims to create a homely environment with a strong programme of activities for residents to enjoy. While robots are unlikely to replace human carers, experts say they could support staff and provide companionship for residents, particularly during quiet periods or when people are feeling lonely. The visits offered residents a chance to experience cutting-edge technology firsthand and sparked lively conversations about how robots might play a role in care homes of the future. There's two images here. So you've got one with the robot in question with a couple of members of staff and one of the residents of the care home. There's another image, which is a larger image with everybody sort of in a line, and you've got staff and a couple of members of the care home as well. And the robot is in the middle of all everybody. And the caption at the bottom reads, "Residents at Newbury Manor Nursing Home in Albury were given a glimpse of the future after welcoming a rare humanoid robot to their home for a special demonstration."
A warning about this next article, which involves the description of the murder of a child. You might want to move to the next track if you find this upsetting, as Gavin clearly did.
Detectives talk of devastating baby murder as mother jailed. The lead detective in the devastating case of baby killer Zara Arsalan says he hopes the life term will bring justice for little Harleen and her family. Arsalan, also known as Shadandeep Talwandi of Floyer Flower Road, Borsley Green, was yesterday sentenced to a minimum of 18 years in prison without parole following the death of two-month-old Harleen Baines in 2020. Emergency services were called to the scene of Caddick Crescent, West Bromwich, in July 2020, following reports that a baby girl was unresponsive after falling from her mother's lap. When paramedics arrived at the address, however, they found that baby Harleen's breathing was unstable and that she had serious head injury. Sadly, she died from her injuries the next day. A post-mortem investigation revealed that Harleen had multiple skull fractures, bleeding to the brain, fractured ribs, and a fractured collarbone, injuries that were not consistent with a fall. A murder investigation was launched, leading to the arrest, charge, and conviction of 31-year-old Arsalan on February the 20th. Now Detective Chief Inspector Phil Poole from the West Midlands Police Homicide Unit has spoken about the significant and devastating case. He said the sentencing is very significant, primarily due to the very horrible and sad way in which Harleen sadly died. The death of a child has a massive ripple effect on both the family of the child and the wider community. We hope that this conviction has brought justice to Harleen. When faced with the charges, Artalan entered a plea of not guilty, claiming instead that Harleen had simply fallen from her lap after she, Artalan, was punched by her ex-partner and Harleen's father, Jatinder Baines. However, despite being monitored by social services, DCI Paul said that there was no learning to take away regarding the early care for Harleen Baines and commended the jury for seeing through Arsalan's defence. He said any previous social services involvement in the case was robustly examined, and it's my understanding that there is no specific learning to take away regarding the early care of Harleen. A suspect can say what they want to say, but the medical evidence speaks volumes. We secure this evidence at the earliest opportunity, and that was instrumental in securing this conviction. The jury has heard some significant and detailed evidence around the injuries and the accounts that the mother provided, and thankfully they saw through her account and returned that guilty verdict. DCI Paul said Harleen's family had been continuously supported through the trial. He added, incidents like this are rare, but we have a high level of expertise in working alongside our partners when it comes to bringing these people to justice. The sentencing should serve as a reminder to people of the serious nature of this offence and a reminder that we will continue to work with our partners to protect the vulnerable people of the West Midlands. At yesterday's sentencing, Judge John Kavanagh said whilst the act Arsalan committed against her daughter was not premeditated and planned, and there was evidence she loved Harleen, the injuries sustained to her could only have been caused by an act of extreme and ferocious violence. He said, there is little mitigating evidence in terms of the act which killed baby Bambi. There was evidence throughout the trial, and forensic evidence showed she hit her head on a hard surface which was found to be the floor. It was a sudden fit of rage that caused the attack, but the fact it was not planned does not mitigate the fact of what the defendant did. Only 2 days before, baby Bambi had suffered fractured ribs in another incident, and if she was struggling in any way, many new mothers do, she was given ample support by nurses, health visitors and midwives, and the chance to tell them this and get help. Addressing Arsalan, he said, in the moment of committing the act, you did not care if you killed her, although you did try to revive her during the 999 call and haven't expressed any remorse since. Throughout the trial, the jury heard evidence of a volatile relationship between Arsalan and Harleen's father, Jatinder Baines, but Judge Kavanagh said she had given as good as she got with the former cage fighter, who, he said, committed suicide in August 2022. He said, nothing I can do will provide recompense for the death of Harleen, who was a tiny child who had a potentially long life ahead of her enjoying the joys that can bring, but she was denied by this act. There's two images here. One of Detective Chief Inspector Phil Poole hopes the sentence will bring justice, and it's a picture of Detective Chief Inspector Phil Poole, just standard photo of him taken at the camera, and there is a picture of Zara Arsalan, who's been jailed.
Hello everyone, this is Linda, reading from Saturday the 14th of March's Express and Star. Plan for 23-room B&B backed to save club from jeopardy. Plans to build a bed and breakfast above a social club to save it from jeopardy have been approved. Sandwell Council has given the green light to convert a first-floor function room, a Cradley Heath Sports and Social Club in Upper High Street, Cradley Heath, into a 28-room B&B. The planning application by owners Westbourne Leisure said the club, which opened in 2005, is in real jeopardy, without significant investment to create new revenue streams. The club's existing lounge bar, games room and ground floor function room will also be refurbished as part of the work. The planning application said the club's 180 capacity first floor function room and dining room did not make enough money to justify using them and currently sit empty. The plans were slightly redrawn after submission, with a reception and dining room for up to 48 guests added to the layout. Approving the application, Sandwell Council's planner said the development would be contained within the existing first floor space and would involve only minor external alterations to the building. Given the nature and scale of the proposed bed and breakfast use, the location of the building within a mixed-use area, and the fact that the existing first floor contains a large function room capable of hosting a significant number of patrons, it is not considered that the proposal would result in unacceptable levels of noise or disturbance to neighbouring properties. The scale of the proposed accommodation is relatively small and would not be expected to generate significant traffic movements. The proposed change of use of the first floor function room to bed and breakfast accommodation represents an appropriate reuse of existing floor space. 10,581 hours. That's the amount of time lost by ambulance crews waiting outside A&E. Ambulances continue to be stuck outside hospitals waiting to hand over patients, with more than 10,000 hours lost in a single month in the Black Country alone. There has been a significant increase in paramedics waiting for more than the expected 15 minutes to pass patients to accident and emergency departments. In December 2025, the number of lost hours was recorded at 10,581, more than 1,400 more than in November. Official figures presented to an NHS board meeting for the Black Country highlight the scale of the problem. Royal Wolverhampton NHS Trust, which runs New Cross, recorded the highest individual figure, with 3,799 hours over 15 minutes lost. Dudley Group NHS Foundation Trust, which operates Russell's Hall, was a close second, with the data showing 3,606 hours. Sandwell and West Birmingham Hospitals NHS Trust, which runs the New Midland Met, recorded 1,969 ambulance hours lost, while Walsall Healthcare NHS Trust had 1,257 hours stuck outside Walsall Manor. The Express and Star has reported on long queues of ambulances waiting outside hospitals as winter pressures bite. Today's figures reveal the scale of the problem as more fall ill with issues involving flu, COVID and norovirus. Recent figures showed there were more general and acute hospital beds occupied in mid-January than any point since January 2020. An early day motion on ambulance delays has been submitted by MPs to the Commons, which highlights the particular crisis facing West Midlands Ambulance. It says January was the worst on record in our region, with the equivalent of 135 ambulances being taken off the road each day, and claims that one handover took 14 hours and 47 minutes. A report to a meeting of the NHS Birmingham and Solihull and NHS Black Country Joint ICB Cluster Board said a series of actions were in place to try to address the issue and reduce the amount of time lost. It says, winter plans for each trust are in place and progress against these plans are discussed at Urgent and Emergency Care Operational Group and Programme Board. Performance and activity continues to be monitored daily by the Strategic Command Centre. Change made to tram service for driver training. Metro passengers have been advised of a temporary change to services to help drivers familiarise themselves with the new route extension. West Midlands Metro have said services from Wolverhampton St George's Station will terminate at Bull Street from Monday to allow drivers to follow the new East Side extension via Millennium Point, with passengers enabled to board services at Corporation Street. The East Side extension will provide new and improved public transport links to the east of Birmingham City Centre and Digbeth, and will connect HS2 Curzon Street Station to the Metro network, with four permanent West Midlands Metro stops serving the east of Birmingham city centre. A spokesman for West Midlands Metro said, to allow driver familiarisation to take place on the new East Side extension on the Metro line, from Monday, March the 16th, there will be a temporary change to West Midlands Metro services as follows. Trams departing from Wolverhampton Station will run as normal and serve all stops. Trams departing from Wolverhampton St George's will terminate at Bull Street. The driver will then drive out of service to Millennium Point to complete their training and route familiarisation, rejoining the network at Corporation Street. Every Wednesday, excluding school half terms and holidays, bring your knitting and crochet projects or anything else you may be working on to Oak House Museum in West Bromwich. There will be jigsaws and games available and throughout the coming months in some of the sessions, which run from 10 a.m. until 12:30 p.m. Participants will be able to explore different natural arts and activities to help with feelings of calmness and creativity. Open to all ages, everyone is welcome to attend. It costs £1 and there is no need to book.
Hello, this is Janet reading from the Express and Star for Monday the 16th of March. Memorial plaque unveiled at a ceremony for fallen heroes. A marble plaque that was displayed in a former factory was rededicated by Deborah Hardiman. Around 100 people were in attendance at a poignant ceremony to mark the unveiling of a restored memorial to remember fallen heroes who worked at a former Black Country factory. The special civic event was held on Saturday, March the 14th, to honour the war dead from the now-closed Nuts and Bolts factory, T.W. Lench Limited, that was based in Blackheath. It was the rededication of a marble plaque that was displayed in the former factory before being put in storage when it closed its doors in 2012. Civic dignitaries led by Sandwell Mayor Councillor Steve Melia were joined by the Lench family, residents and former employees in the company's memorial gardens at the junction of Carnegie Road and Yew Tree Lane. The restoration and return of the memorial, which carries the names of the employees who paid the ultimate sacrifice in the First World War and the Second World War, was the dying wish of former chairman Robert Lench, who died aged 89 in 2020. The business was founded in the late 1800s and was in operation for more than a century, with the Excelsior Works famed for its Admiral nuts and bolts. The memorial stone was originally installed in 1923 to remember those who fought and fell in the First World War of 1914 to 1918, also known as the Great War, with the names of those from the Second World War, 1939 to 1945, subsequently added. There are a total of 30 names listed on the plaque and 30 trees planted to commemorate each of the soldiers who did not return still stand in the gardens and in a nearby green space. Robert Lench's daughter, Lindy Lench, said, "I think the ceremony was fabulous, along with the support from the local people. It was beautifully done with solemnity by Sandwell Council and the leader, Councillor Kerry Carmichael, who worked very hard to pull it off. We were also very pleased to see the mayor here and to catch up with people who actually worked at Lench's. It's been a very poignant day. Robert died in 2020 and it was his wish that the memorial came back to the gardens. When the factory land opposite was sold, one of the conditions of the sale was that this part would remain untouched so that the stone was relaid here. For him, it was very important that this was done and that those who lost their lives would be remembered. Lench was the product of four generations and we are very proud and honoured to be here. As the fifth generation, we still feel that our foundations are here in this community and we will always be part of it." She was among several family members based in Kidderminster, Bewdley and Worcester to attend the event, which comprised the unveiling of the plaque, an act of remembrance led by Blackheath Royal British Legion branch, the playing of the last post, a minute silence and reveille, wreath laying and speeches followed by refreshments at the area's Britannia Park Sons of Rest Hall. Gang members who carried out raids told to pay £1 each. Jail men have no known assets, so judge gives nominal compensation orders. Two members of a gang who were sentenced to more than 30 years in prison between them for a highly organised conspiracy to steal thousands of pounds worth of items have been ordered to pay back just £1. A proceeds of crime hearing at Wolverhampton Crown Court dealt with three members of the nine-man gang, which carried out raids nationwide, including at firms in Walsall, Albury, Willenhall and Telford between October 2019 and February 2022. Driver Christopher Aston, originally from Hodder Grove, West Bromwich, who was jailed for 3 years in November 2024 for his part in the crime, was not present in court. The three raids he was said to have taken part in included the theft of items from B&Q, as well as trailers with a total value of items of £80,572.89, one of Stella Artois, and pallets to the total of £28,212.80, and one of fluffy hot water bottles worth £84,059.02, as well as £40 worth of chocolate. In total, he was said to benefit from the three to the tune of £44,619.80. But his solicitor, Michael Cadwallader, said he was paid a flat fee of £1,000 and didn't get any of the proceeds. With no known assets to speak of, Aston was ordered to pay a nominal fee of £1. Alan Edwards, originally from Tiverdale, was said to have benefited from £87,000 for his part in the crimes and was ordered to pay just £1. But Gary Harvey of Wensbury, who was originally given a 3-year and 9-month sentence, originally by Judge Michael Chambers, had already had £4,800 of assets seized by the police, and this was used as payment towards a total of £288,606 he was said to have benefited from. No other compensation order was made. Hospital opens new cardiac facility to cut waiting times. Midland Met Cath Lab designed to support patients who need a pacemaker. The Midland Metropolitan University Hospital has opened a new cardiac catheter lab, which will reduce waiting times for patients undergoing cardiology procedures. The new cardiac catheter lab, otherwise known as a cath lab, will specialise in cardiac pacing, which means patients who need a pacemaker will be seen more quickly. Last year, Sandwell and West Birmingham NHS Trust performed just under 500 pacing procedures. It will also improve the hospital's ability to provide emergency care to patients who need urgent life-saving treatment, as it will free up space in the hospital's other two interventional cath labs. Dr. Abdul Mayer, consultant cardiology with a special interest in complex cardiac devices and cardiac imaging, said the extra capacity that this development creates and the fact it will be primarily for patients needing pacemakers and defibrillators will be of huge benefit to those we look after. These devices can be life-saving and life-transforming, so the opening of this cath lab at the Midland Met is a very exciting day for our teams and great news for our patients. One of the first patients to be treated in the new cath lab was 68-year-old Jean Farnworth. Jean was told by a cardiologist in January that she would need a pacemaker fitted after her implantable loop recorder had detected her heart rate had reached dangerously low levels. She said, "I've been on the waiting list for an appointment and then I was offered this surgery earlier than planned." Dr. Vinoda Sharman, consultant interventional cardiologist and cardiology clinical speciality lead who worked on the opening, added, "The third cath lab will help patients get timely care, cut waiting lists and help with patient flow." MP is calling for health inequality debate in tribute. A Black Country MP has called for a parliamentary debate on health inequalities in tribute to a councillor who died this year, aged 44. Sarah Coombs, MP for West Bromwich, said Wasim Zafar was a close friend who cared greatly about inequalities in healthcare. Councillor Zafar, who represented Lascelles Ward on Birmingham Council, died suddenly in January at the age of 44. Ms. Coombs said the news had left her heartbroken. She told the Commons, "There was no prouder Brummie than Wasim. He loved the city, he loved the villa, and he loved representing the people of Lascelles. As the Cabinet Member for Transport, he was the driving force behind the city's clean air zone, and he fought every day against the health inequalities that mean so many Brummies die too young. I will miss Wasim more than I can say. He leaves a hole in the city that will be very difficult to fill." She asked Leader of the House, Sir Alan Campbell, to join her in sending deepest condolences to Councillor Zafar's wife, Aisha, his four sons and his wider family, and also asked for a debate on health inequality, a subject dear to his heart. Sir Alan replied that he totally supported her tribute to Councillor Zafar.
Hello, this is Trevor reading articles from the Express and Star for Tuesday, the 17th of March. Former Tory joins Green Party, doubling numbers on Borough Council. The Green Party has doubled its number of councillors on Sandwell Council after former Conservative councillor William Gill joined its ranks. Greatbridge councillor William Gill was elected for the Conservatives in 2021. Will be standing for the Greens in May's crucial all-out elections in Sandwell. The 23-year-old said, "I'm so pleased to be part of the party that is offering a real, positive alternative for the people of Sandwell." Explaining his journey from representing the Tories under Boris Johnson to joining the left-leaning environmentalists, Councillor Gill said, "At the time, the Tories were the only serious challenge to the Labour administration." Eschewing the populist policies of Kemi Badenoch, Councillor Gill left the party he had joined as a child last November. He said, "I went independent when it became clear that their policies, as well as Labour's, were moving further away from what is needed for a thriving and cohesive community in Sandwell. It's great that Sandwell now has a strong and growing Green Party, which feels like a natural home. I will continue to be an exceptionally hard-working councillor for Greatbridge." Gill is the second sitting councillor to join Sandwell's Greens in 2 years. Cradley Heath and Old Hill councillor John Tipper won two elections for the party he called home since cutting his teeth organising as a teenager. Councillor Tipper joined the Greens in February 2025 and quickly began preparing the party for May's elections, in which the party plans to stand in every seat. Councillor Tipper welcomed his new colleague after being impressed with the Greatbridge councillor's previous willingness to put people before policies. He said, "I have worked well with Will and other councillors to get better outcomes for Sandwell, and now we'll be even better able to do so." Elected councillors J. joining the Greens is becoming more frequent ahead of May's local elections, with the party polling in first place with under 65s. Under Zach Polanski's leadership, the party's victory in the Gorton and Denton by-election added another Green MP to their team at Westminster. Aldo Moosey, coordinator of Sandwell Green Party, said, "I'm delighted to have Will join our busy and growing team. The national increase in members and voting intention for the Greens is also happening here in Sandwell, and we are here ready to offer something better for Sandwell people in the May elections." Woman banned from keeping animals for 10 years by court. This article is by James Vukmirovich. A woman has been banned from keeping animals for a decade after admitting abandoning her two dogs and cat in a flat filled with urine and faeces. Hayley Whitehouse pleaded guilty at Birmingham Magistrates Court to three offences under the Animal Welfare Act following a prosecution brought by the RSPCA. The court heard how RSPCA Animal Rescue Officer Balji Dharmia had first attended the property in Wednesbury on May 7th, 2024. Following reports, two dogs had been left alone inside. There was no answer when he knocked, but he said he was drawn to the strong smell of ammonia and faeces and he could hear two large dogs barking. He left a warning notice and placed tape seals on the door as part of the Animals Welfare Charity's 24-hour abandonment procedure. And 2 days later, Animal Rescue Officer Ashley Moore attended for a follow-up. The tape seals remained intact and the dogs could still be heard barking. So on May the 10th, officers returned alongside West Midlands Police and entered the property. In a statement to the court, Mr. Moore said, "We were met by a very strong smell of urine and faeces. The property was in a severe state of disrepair. There was no food or water available to the dogs. Two female bull-bred dogs and a severely underweight female cat, also belonging to Whitehouse, were taken into RSPCA care and transported to RSPCA Birmingham Animal Hospital. A vet who examined the pets found that all three were underweight and in a statement to the court said that they had been kept in an unsuitable environment without adequate food, water or appropriate care. At Birmingham Magistrates Court on March 6, Whitehouse, aged 29 of Wolhampton Street in Wednesbury, was handed a 12-month community order including 20 rehabilitation activity requirement days alongside a 10-year ban on keeping all animals and was also ordered to pay £50 in costs. In mitigation, the court heard that Whitehouse had been through a difficult time experiencing domestic abuse and mental health issues and she expressed remorse for her actions. All three animals have now been rehomed. Debrief. Hungry baggies are finally back to winning ways. This article is by Lewis Cox. It's been a long time coming, but Albion breathed new life into their championship survival bid with a first victory of 2026. James Morrison's men were convincing 3-0 winners over Hull City in one of the finest displays in recent memory. Here are some of the talking points from the Tigers' mauling in the latest debrief. Relentless hunger. Former boss Ryan Mason used to pledge his belief in Albion's energy and running stats, but here the eye test showed us a side running harder than they have done for some time. That was more eye-catching given it was the third game in 8 days and came less than 72 hours after the late heartache against Southampton. Morrison admitted he was apprehensive of his squad's levels ahead of the clash. But right from the first whistle, it was clear that every Albion player knew what was at stake. Hull, with a fine away record, were blown away. Without the ball, the baggies swarmed and smothered as they hunted in packs. Sergei Jekirovich's visitors, who had an extra 24 hours preparation, could not cope, and the boss admitted as much afterwards. With the ball, 26 shots at goal was the joint most Albion have managed all season. 8 untargeted represented decent accuracy. For once, Albion were clinical. Leading the way, undoubtedly, the baggies' right flank of lone right-back Danny Imrie and captain Jed Wallace. Both set the tone with Hull's Liam Miller and replacement Cody Drammer unable to live with the relentless attacks down that side. Imrie had previously displayed an attacking capability, but his defensive frailties have been apparent. Here, the 22-year-old showed power and poise with the ball. His touch was clean. His delivery was on point. He deserved a late assist for Isaac Price. Wallace gave a captain's performance, as he, by and large, since an injured return in January. This was up with the best as the winger, 32 next week, rolled back the years with an electric display. He doesn't have the speed he used to, but he makes up for it with energy and commitment. He jumped onto goalkeeper Ivo Pandur's error to lay on Josh Matter's opener to settle Albion. Left-back Callum Stars is so often Albion's threat from a deep position out wide. To have both flanks on board is a big boost. Attacker Price has taken no shortage of flak during this disastrous campaign, but he fired back here. The Northern Ireland international, 22, often takes criticism, perceived poor body language, but he seldom shirks his running responsibility. Price's pressing is a big weapon of Albion's. It has not paid off a lot this season, but did here. He deserved that late third goal, and it was a cool finish for just a second goal since October. Despite that, a tally of 7 is not to be sniffed at, but should be so much greater. There was a real meaning in his celebration. Price may, for whatever reason, not to be every Albion fan's cup of tea. He's not alone, but he has the touch and energy that set him apart from most of the squad. On the subject of attackers, he was joined by striker duo Arne Hegbo and Josh Madger on the score sheet as Morrison's retro 4-4-2 formation delivered again. For Norwegian top scorer Hegbo, it was the 10th goal of the season in all competitions, as he finally ended a 17-game drought with a smart finish. For Madger, his opener and entire performance was a glimpse back to some 15 months to the player who tore up the championship in the first half of 2024-25. Head coach Morrison politely declined the request of a wave from the Smethwick end in the first half with the scoreline at 1-0. He knew there was a job to be done and did not want to come across disrespectful to Hull. At 2-0 late in the contest, he satisfied the locals with a quick acknowledgement. More striking was his subtle but meaningful clenched fist to the fans at full time. Morrison, so humble and reserved in how he carries himself, knew the win was critical. He knew players and fans were united in the fight. Wife killed for seeking divorce. Trial told victim lay with knife by her side, but with evidence of strangulation. This article's by Paul Jenkins. A woman found dead at her Maddal home in the Black Country was in a deeply unhappy relationship with the man accused of her murder and was seeking a divorce, a court was told at the start of a trial. Wolverhampton Crown Court heard Paramjit Kaur, aged 46, was found dead on Monday, March the 31st, around 8 a.m. at the home in Swan Crescent, Albury, that she shared with her husband, Harminder Matu. Forensic evidence showed she had died the previous night around 11 p.m. with a knife found by her side, although there was evidence of strangulation. Matu, aged 50, also a Swan Crescent, is accused of her murder, a charge he denies. On the first day of his trial, prosecuting solicitor Jonathan Barker said the couple had been married for nearly 10 years after Paramjit had come to the UK from India, initially staying with her cousin before meeting Matu. But the court was told the relationship had been deeply unhappy, at least on her side. And just a month before she was found dead, she applied for a divorce, giving reasons of irrevocable breakdown of marriage. Addressing the jury, Mr. Barker said, "You will hear there were clear signs she was deeply unhappy and the marriage had problems. There were no children and there was little physical contact, something we say caused this defendant frustration, which they both argued about. It was a relationship which was also blighted, we say, by Matthew's heavy drinking, which made him volatile at times. The divorce petition is a matter of record and also a complaint from the victim in December 2024, to the police about violent argument. She had gone out for the night and came back late, returning home after a party, which he questioned. And when she mentioned about pursuing a divorce, he became vicious, slapping her face, injuring her leg and breaking her mobile phone, although she chose not to press charges. During this interview, she also recounted to police a previous incident in February 2023, when he placed his hands round her throat, causing her to struggle to breathe and eventually lose consciousness. This caused her to move out because she was terrified of the defendant and had already looked for a way to divorce him for many years. The court heard she moved in initially with her cousin, Handy's wife again, and then with a friend and colleague from Panasar Foods where she worked. She only moved back in with Matu when he threatened to harm himself. Earlier, the court heard Matu had initially gone to West Bromwich Police Station in the hours after the alleged murder, after walking around the streets through the night and told staff at the front desk he had killed someone. But when he was eventually questioned by detectives under caution about the death, he answered no comment. The trial, which is expected to last 2 weeks, continues.
Welcome back to the Express and Star pub quiz. Question 1. News. How much did a UK ticket holder win in Tuesday's Euro Millions draw jackpot? Question 2. Which musical triumphed at the What's on Stage Awards with 9 gongs, including Best New Musical and Best Costume Design? Question 3. Sport. Sir Jason Kenny won how many Olympic cycling medals during his career? Question 4. England spinner Sophie Eccleston represents which county cricket club? Question 5. Remember when? Elvis Presley made his first appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show. Look Back in Anger opened at the Royal Court. The Red Army crushed the Hungarian Revolution. And Rocky Marciano retired undefeated. Question 6. Czechoslovakia officially became 2 independent states. Frank Zappa and Conway Twitty died. Kim Campbell became Canada's first female prime minister. Question 7. Who am I? A television presenter. I was born in Wales in 1959. In 1998, I was shocked to learn that my biological father was television presenter Huey Green. I was married to Bob Geldof, with whom I had 3 daughters, and had a relationship with INXS singer Michael Hutchins, with whom I had 1 daughter. Question 8. An actor, I was born in Iowa in 1978. I found fame playing Michael Kelso in sitcom That 70s Show and have starred in the films A Lot Like Love and The Butterfly Effect. I was married to Demi Moore from 2005 to 2013 and married Mila Kunis in 2015. Question 9. Local questions. At the March 2026 Venture Fest, Birmingham father and son duo Eugene and Ivor Patterson won £15,000 to share their superfood creation with the world. By what name is their refreshing Birmingham business known? And question 10. Which film series will be featured on a special set of Royal Mail stamps to mark the 25th anniversary of the first movie? How's your quiz knowledge? Click to the answers to find out. Here are the answers for this week's quiz. Question 1. News. How much did a UK ticket holder win in Tuesday's Euro Millions draw jackpot? £181 million. Question 2. Which musical triumphed at the What's on Stage Awards with 9 gongs, including Best New Musical and Best Costume Design? Paddington the Musical. Question 3. Sport. Sir Jason Kenny won how many Olympic cycling medals during his career? Nine, seven gold and two silver. Question four. England spinner Sophie Eccleston represents which county cricket club? Lancashire. Question five. Remember when? Elvis Presley made his first appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show. Look Back in Anger opened at the Royal Court. The Red Army crushed the Hungarian Revolution. And Rocky Marciano retired undefeated. Question 6. Czechoslovakia officially became two independent states. Frank Zappa and Conway Twitty died. Kim Campbell became Canada's first female prime minister. Question 7. Who am I? A television presenter. I was born in Wales in 1959. In 1998, I was shocked to learn that my biological father was television presenter Huey Green. I was married to Bob Geldof, with whom I had three daughters, and had a relationship with In Excess singer Michael Hutchins, with whom I had one daughter. Paula Yates. Question 8. An actor, I was born in Iowa in 1978. I found fame playing Michael Kelso in sitcom That 70s Show and have starred in the films A Lot Like Love and The Butterfly Effect. I was married to Demi Moore from 2005 to 2013 and married Mila Kunis in 2015. Ashton Kutcher. Question 9. Local questions. At the March 2026 Venture Fest, Birmingham father and son duo Eugene and Ivor Patterson won £15,000 to share their superfood creation with the world. By what name is their refreshing Birmingham business known? Revived drinks. And question 10. Which film series will be featured on a special set of Royal Mail stamps to mark the 25th anniversary of their first movie? Lord of the Rings. Thanks for joining me in this week's quiz. I'm Sarah Ann, and I'll be back next time. Bye!
Some audio described TV programmes for the next week along with radio programme highlights from Talking News Federation. Search for publications TNF Soundings to hear these directly on their website.
TNF Soundings.
Hello, this is Chris welcoming you to your audio described TV programmes, starting Saturday the 21st and ending Friday the 27th of March, which has been written by Christine. Starting with Saturday, the usual morning American sitcom fest runs from 10 past 6 through to 11:45 on Channel 4, featuring episodes of King of Queens, Everybody Loves Raymond, Frasier and The Simpsons. Or you could opt to Love Your Garden with Alan Titchmarsh at 6:30 a.m. on ITV. Go bargain hunting at Cheltenham Racecourse with The Auction Teams on BBC One at 1 o'clock, or enjoy the classic film The Third Man on BBC Two, also at 1. Kirsty and Phil's Love It or List It is at 2:20 on Channel 4. Then you have two more afternoon film choices. The Addams Family 2 at 3 p.m. on BBC One, and romantic comedy Sleepless in Seattle on Channel 4 at 4:25. Sun bears in Borneo, Javan green magpies, and Sunda pangolins in Singapore feature in the final episode of BBC One's Asia series at 4:25, followed by the last semi-final of Gladiators at 5:45. Celebrities and would-be celebrities take over ITV's evening schedule with a new series of Celebrity Catchphrase at 5:45, followed by Britain's Got Talent at 6:45, and Celebrity Sabotage at 8, a new reality game show that sees celebrities cause chaos to win money for unsuspecting contestants of fake TV shows. The Race for Ancient Egypt continues on Channel 4 at 7, followed by Roman Empire by Train with Alice Roberts at 8, and Bill Bailey's Vietnam at 9. Over on BBC One, it's Casualty at 8:30, followed by the penultimate episode of The Walsh Sisters at 9:15. ITV offers quiz show The 1% Club at 9, followed by It'll Be All Right on the Night at 11:15. And there are two evening film choices for you. Mission Impossible Rogue Nation on Channel 4 at 10, and After Sun on BBC Two at 11:45. On to Sunday. Again, fans of American sitcom series can get an early fix from 5:55 a.m. right through to 2:30 p.m. on Channel 4. With King of Queens, Everybody Loves Raymond, Frasier and The Simpsons. Whilst over on BBC One, you can enjoy Pilgrimage, The Road to the Scottish Isles at 10:30 a.m. and on ITV, Fletcher's Family Farm at 11:30 a.m. Your afternoon choices start at 1:10, with Britain's Got Talent on ITV, followed by Celebrity Sabotage at 2:25. Over on BBC One, it's Gladiators at 2:05, followed by a new series, Crookhaven, about a school for crooks, where students are taught to beat criminals at their own game. First episode at 3:05, followed by episode 2 at 3:50. Over on Channel 4, it's George Clark's Amazing Spaces at 3:30. Followed by Devon and Cornwall at 4:35, this episode featuring a steam engine enthusiast and champion free drivers. Into the evening, and you have a film choice at 6:05 on Channel 4, Oscar-winning family animation Toy Story, whilst BBC One has episodes 3 and 4 of The Other Bennett Sister at 8 and 8:30. Followed by The Capture at 9. Joe Wilkinson, Roisin Conaty, Rose Matafeo, Judy Love, Tom Davis and John Richardson recreate the weirdest places they've ever slept in cake form in the Great Celebrity Bake Off for Stand Up to Cancer on Channel 4 at 7:40. Followed by the first of a new reality game show series, The Hunt, Prey vs. Predator, at 9, where contestants are pitted against each other to win £100,000. Your evening options conclude on Channel 4 with Gogglebox at 10:05 and First Dates at 11. Now for the programmes which are on at the same time, same channel, each weekday. Channel 4 has episodes of Everybody Loves Raymond at 7:50 a.m, Frasier from 9:10 a.m, Find It, Fix It, Flog It at 12:10, and Matt Baker's Our Farm in the Dales at 1:10 p.m. BBC One's Bargain Hunt is at 12:15 each weekday, and Repair Job on the Road at 3:45 each weekday except Wednesday. ITV gives you Celebrity Catchphrase at 1 o'clock and Deal or No Deal at 3. Then the soaps are on at their usual times every day except Friday. EastEnders 7:30 on BBC One, Emmerdale 8 o'clock and Coronation Street 8:30 on ITV. And on to Monday. BBC One has a new series, Just One Thing, at 2 o'clock. In the first episode, Clive Myrie advocates the health benefits of eating fish that are rich in omega-3. And it's the penultimate episode of Serengeti at 3:30 on BBC Two. In the evening, you have Fletcher's Family Farm at 7:30 on ITV and Batch from Scratch, Cooking for Less at 8 on Channel 4. At 9 o'clock, the final four compete in MasterChef The Professionals on BBC One, and you have Clash of the Superpowers, America versus China on BBC Two, the first of a two-parter which explores how the USA and China have become locked in a battle for global power and influence. On ITV, it's the final part of mystery drama series Gone, and Channel 4 has adventure reality contest The Hunt, Prey versus Predator. Mortimer and Whitehouse have gone fishing again at 10 on BBC Two, and it's the Great Celebrity Bake Off Stand Up for Cancer at 10:05 on Channel 4. There are two episodes of Trying on BBC One from 10:40 p.m. Documentary series True Crime Presents is on ITV at 10:45. Katia Adler concludes her Europe on the Edge series on BBC Two at 11, and Channel 4 has Naked Attraction at 11:25. On to Tuesday. A Sheffield couple discover the benefits of dance in Just One Thing on BBC One at 2 o'clock, and Kike the Cheetah and wild dog leader Jasari teach their cubs to survive alone in Serengeti on BBC Two at 3:30. Contestants from Yorkshire and North East England compete in the Great British Menu at 6:30 on BBC Two. And Bradley and Barney Walsh continue to explore Japan in Breaking Dad on ITV at 7:30. You can visit the Doghouse on Channel 4, or Let Stacey Solomon Help Sort Your Life Out on BBC One, both at 8. Then at 9, you have Prey versus Predator on Channel 4, MasterChef The Professionals on BBC One, or documentary WhatsApp Obsession on ITV. Inside Number 9 is at 10 o'clock on BBC Two. Gogglebox is at 10:05 on Channel 4, and there are two episodes of Borders on BBC One from 10:40. Your evening choices conclude with Forensics, The Real CSI, on BBC Two at 11. Next, the programmes for Wednesday. Zoe Ball heads to South London to teach a charity worker the benefits of gardening in Just One Thing at 2 p.m. on BBC One. And a tiny turtle hatchling hunts for suitable wetland in Canada in Big Little Journeys on BBC Two at 3:30. The three remaining hopefuls serve main courses and desserts celebrating British film in Great British Menu on BBC Two at 7 p.m, followed by the last in the Digging for Britain series at 8. Over on BBC One at 8, it's The Repair Shop, and on Channel 4, it's the start of a new series, Help, I Bought It at Auction, with Sarah Beeney, with the property developer visiting challenging auction purchases in South Wales, Cornwall and London. Drama series A Woman of Substance continues on Channel 4, and it's the last episode of The Stolen Girl on ITV, both at 9 o'clock. There's a new series starting on BBC Two at 9:45, Captive Audience, A Real American Horror Story. The three-parter charts the kidnapping of 7-year-old Stephen Steyer from his California home in 1972 and his remarkable return 7 years later. A three-part series examining the Moors murders runs from 10 o'clock into the early hours on Channel 4, and you have a late film choice at 11:30 on BBC Two, The Duchess, starring Keira Knightley as the Duchess of Devonshire. And on to Thursday. Clive Myrie discovers how swapping coffee for tea could lower stress levels in Just One Thing at 2 o'clock on BBC One, and Big Little Journeys follows a family of tamarinds in Brazil at 3:30 on BBC Two. The Great British Menu continues on BBC Two at 6:30, and it's the final of MasterChef The Professionals on BBC One at 8. The three remaining chefs creating their best three-course menu in a bid to be crowned this year's champion. Over on Channel 4, you have George Clark's Building Home. The Apprentice is at 9 on BBC One and The Apprentice Unfinished Business at 10 on BBC Two. A Woman of Substance continues at 9, followed by 24 Hours in A&E at 10, both on Channel 4. WhatsApp Obsession, The Murder of Stephanie Hansen, is at 10:45 on ITV, followed at 11:40 by Heathrow, Britain's busiest airport. Clash of the Superpowers, America vs. China, is at 11 on BBC Two, followed at midnight by a film choice, comedy drama Licorice Pizza. And finally, Friday. In the afternoon, you have Father Brown at 2 on BBC One and Forest Chameleons in Madagascar in Big Little Journeys at 3:30 on BBC Two. Rick Stein's Food Stories heads to the Lake District on BBC Two at 6:30, and there is the start of a new series on BBC One at 7:30, Extraordinary Portraits with Bill Bailey. Beyond Paradise returns with a new series at 8, and it's the last in the current series of Death in Paradise at 9, both on BBC One. The downfall in popularity of the Labour government is examined in Keir Starmer, Labour in Crisis, at 8 on Channel 4, followed by Gogglebox at 9 and The Last Leg at 10. Over on BBC Two, it's Big Cats 24/7 at 9, and ITV has the final episode of the series Devil in Disguise, John Wayne Gacy, at 10:50. That's it for this week. We hope you find plenty of programmes to enjoy, and we look forward to updating you again next week.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, March 21st. And Radio 4 Extra are having an all-request weekend. Loads of great programmes to listen to. We'll highlight some of them for you. One of them, Up Against It, Joe Orton's unfinished screenplay written for the Beatles in 1967 and adapted for radio. It's narrated by Liam McKern and stars Sylvia Sims, Prunella Scales and Joseph Fiennes, among others. Radio 4 Extra, 1:15, Saturday lunchtime. Adaptation of Euripides' Greek tragedy, exploring the root causes of rebellion. Radio 4 at 3 o'clock, Saturday afternoon. On the Beach, a dramatisation of Neville Shute's 1957 post-apocalyptic novel, part 1, Radio 4 Extra at 4. And it concludes next weekend on Saturday, 4 o'clock, Radio 4 Extra. And Saturday evening's opera is Wagner's Tristan and Isolde, Radio 3, 5 p.m. On to Sunday, March 22nd, and a chance to hear classic editions of Alastair Cook's Letter from America. It's Radio 4 Extra at 9:30 in the morning, 2:30 or 8:30. It actually carries on every day this week. Back to Sunday, the castaway is Desert Island Discs, writer and comedian Sarah Pascoe, Radio 4, 10 a.m. Tom Courtney stars as Stan Laurel in the radio play Stan, Radio 4 Extra, 11 a.m. or 5 p.m. License to Hate, Racism on the Front Line, looks into why racist abuse in the NHS is becoming more frequent. Radio 4 at 1:30. And in the series Between the Ears, Elephant Voices explores a unique archive of elephant calls and behaviour. Radio 3, Sunday night, 7:15. On to programmes then, that are broadcast at the same time every day, Monday to Friday. Same time, same radio station, all week. Agatha Christie's They Do It With Mirrors, with June Whitfield as Miss Marple. Radio 4 Extra, 6 in the morning, all week, 11 a.m. or 5 p.m. every day this week. Rogue Justice, the thriller sequel to Jeffrey Household's Rogue Mail, is on Radio 4 Extra, again at 6:30 in the morning, 11:30 or 5:30 p.m. Monday to Friday. Book of the Week is A History of Mystery by Cal Flynn, Radio 4, 11:45, all week. William Fine's Memoir of a Magical Childhood Spent in a Moated Castle, The Music Room, Radio 4 Extra, 8:30 a.m, 1:30 p.m. lunchtime, or 7:30 p.m. Monday to Friday. What do our politicians need to know? Ask whether politicians need to update their skill set to deal with the challenges of today's world. Radio 4, all week at 1:45. Composer of the Week is Thomas Eades, born 1971. Radio 3, 4 o'clock, Monday to Friday. And the essay, Erlen Cooper's Cities of the Imagination, takes us on an imaginary journey to mythical cities. Radio 3, 9:45 p.m. And Book of Bedtime, The Woman Who Saw Atoms, by Pippa Goldschmidt, about Marietta Blau, a Jewish scientist who captured an image of a proton. Radio 4, 10:45 p.m, Monday to Friday. Back to the individual programmes then to listen to through the week, starting with Monday, March 23rd. And the Academy Award celebrates the 1971 crime drama, The French Connection. Radio 4 Extra, 10 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock on Monday afternoon. Fans of the panel show have three to enjoy. An episode of Just a Minute on Radio 4 Extra at 2 or 8 p.m. The Kitchen Cabinet, Radio 4 at 4:30 p.m. And in the comedy slot, there's Unspeakable on Radio 4 at 6:30 p.m. Finally, for Monday in the series How Did We Get Here, this week's episode looks at 1967 to 1982, from the Six-Day War to the War on Lebanon. Radio 4, 8 p.m. Tuesday, March 24th, in Gift of the Gods, Martha Kearney travels to Greece to explore the impact of honey. It's on Radio 4 Extra at 10:30 a.m. or 4:30 p.m. Mr. and Mrs. Nobody, a comic play from 1990 by Keith Waterhouse, based on the novel Diary of a Nobody, stars Judy Dench and Michael Williams, husband and wife, of course, at the time. Radio 4 Extra, 3 o'clock or 9 p.m. The last Sweeping Beams looks at the place of lighthouses in the cultural imagination as one by one their sweeping beams are switched off and replaced by LED lights. Radio 4, 4 p.m. File on 4 Investigates asks the question, are our transplant services in decline? Radio 4 at 8 p.m. While In Touch brings us news, views, information for people who are blind or partially sighted. Presented as usual by Peter White. Radio 4, 8:40 p.m. Tuesday. Wednesday, March 25th. After Henry, Simon Brett's 1985 comedy, starts a new series on Radio 4 Extra at 7 a.m, 12 noon or 6 p.m. In Archive on 4, Alistair Cook's Century. In 1999, the broadcaster looked back on his extraordinary transatlantic career in broadcasting. Radio 4 Extra at 10 a.m. or 4 p.m. Choral Evensong from St. Barnabas Church in Ealing is on Radio 3 at 3. While Dedication, a play presenting three versions of Shakespeare's relationship with the Earl of Southampton. Part 1 on Radio 4 Extra at 3 or 9 p.m. And it's Part 2 on Thursday at the same time. Back to Wednesday afternoon, Money, Influence and the NHS continues to look at conflicts of interest in medicine. It's Time Patients Knew is on Radio 4 at 3:30 p.m. While The Life Scientific looks at work of the Cape Verde Atmospheric Observatory, which shows that ozone loss is not just a problem created by humans. Radio 4, 9 p.m. Wednesday. Thursday, March 26th, in Great Lives, Caroline Quinton assesses the legacy of flamboyant dramatist and architect John Vanbrugh, designer of Blenheim Palace and Castle Howard. Radio 4, Extra, at 10 a.m. or 4 p.m. Loud Organs, His Glory, examines the legacy of Victorian organ builder Henry Willis, on Radio 4 Extra at 10:30 in the morning or 4:30 p.m. In the series The Second Map, The Battered Suitcase explores the complex remembrance of the war on the Asian front, which continued for 3 months after the celebrations of VE Day. Radio 4, 11 a.m. While in open country this week, Martha Kearney visits the Essex coast to learn about the Wallasey Island Wild Coast Restoration Project. Radio 4, 3 p.m. While BBC Inside Science is on Radio 4 at 4:30 on Thursday afternoon. Finally, Friday, March 27th, and Rare Earth looks at the future of sport, both the ecological impact of major sporting events and the effect on climate of sport at every level. Radio 4, just after midday. In the series Life Without, Alan Davis looks at the history of handwriting and considers what life would be like if humans never picked up a pen again. Radio 4, 2:45 p.m. South on the Great North Road is a drama inspired by Sting's 2016 song, recalling his bittersweet feelings as a young man leaving Newcastle for London. Radio 4 Extra, Friday afternoon at 3 or 9 p.m. in the evening. This week's edition of Sideways asks whether people have a moral duty to use exceptional talents on Radio 4 at 4:30. While Friday night is indeed music night and a showcase of Broadway and West End musicals, including works by Rodgers and Hammerstein, Sondheim, Andrew Lloyd Webber and others, is on Radio 3 at 7:30 on Friday night. That's it. Thank you to Wendy for the highlights this week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one of radio listening.
TNS Soundings.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
My name is Lindsay. I started producing topical items during lockdown to keep my neighbours entertained. All the recordings are made inside my cosy cabin for that extra sense of calm. And naturally enough, I call them cabin conversations. I hope you enjoy them. Cabin conversations about World Speech Day. The successful evolution of humans is partly due to effective communication, helping societies grow and flourish throughout the centuries. World Speech Day, celebrated on the 15th of March annually, taps into this basic desire and need to communicate verbally on a range of subjects with other groups of people, but on a global scale. Founded in 2015 by a commercial freelance speechwriter, Simon Gibson, via the Athens Democracy Forum and online opportunities from 2020. The day encourages free speech from all social classes, bringing together world citizens at events held in universities, schools, cafes, community groups and speakers clubs in over 100 countries, thus giving voice to individuals with the potential for inspiring others and promoting cultural change in the world. Of course, to most people, the classic historic public speeches of note in Britain have related to the Royal Christmas Message, started by King George V in 1932, the King George VI Declaration of War on radio in September 1939, the wartime Prime Minister Winston Churchill, "We shall fight them on the beaches," address to Parliament in June 1940, and the modern-day International Olympic Committee ceremonial opening of the Olympic Games back in London 2012. In fact, public speaking to thousands of people was even more daunting for King George VI because of his stammer, and he had to employ a speech therapist to improve the clarity of his spoken words. According to one BBC radio interview, Ed Balls, the ex-Labour cabinet minister, now TV presenter, and Gareth Gates, the pop singer, talked about having speech issues and yet maintaining public careers. Ed mentioned two main types of stammers. He has a covert, interiorised stammer, where words get blocked and struggles with long pauses before brain and voice connect. Whereas Gareth has the overt exteriorised stammer, meaning a portion of certain words are repeated vocally aloud, the latter having been dramatised by the character Arkwright in the TV comedy series Open All Hours, which actor Ronnie Barker embodied with a repeating fake stammer. This inclusiveness was surprisingly welcomed by those fans with genuine stammers. Actually, public speeches and the power of spoken words in everyday lives are more commonplace than we realise. For example, anyone who has attended a wedding may have heard the father of the bride, the groom, the bride, or best man make a heartfelt speech about their mutual love and uniting of both families. Various ceremonies involving celebrities or personal achievements, like graduation, milestone anniversaries, or retirement, all rely on some kind of acknowledgement or acceptance speech. Formal dinners are perceived to require a toastmaster for the occasion. However, this is not the organisation's goal. Since 1924, Toastmasters International has transformed nearly 8 million lives. Their mission to empower individuals to become more effective communicators and leaders. Indeed, simply meeting a diverse, interesting group of people at the clubs helps with creating a safe environment for members to hone their presentation skills and overcome any fear of public speaking. How can public speaking make changes to general society, though? Well, the UK in the Middle Ages, just after the Norman Conquest of 1066, and long before compulsory education, needed to convey vital public information verbally to the illiterate among the population, and this role evolved into the town crier. Appointed messengers elaborately dressed in livery to stand out and show authority. Traditionally in a red and gold coat, white trouser breeches, black boots, and wearing a tricorn. That's a three-corner hat. These days, the hat sports large feathers to represent the earlier writing quills. Originally, town criers would stand outside a local inn with their wives ringing a handbell while the husband shouted the words, "Oh yay! Oh yay! Oh yay!" to attract people's attention before proceeding with reading the announcement, and end with "God save the king" or "queen," depending on the current reigning monarch. "Oh yays" taken from the Anglo-Norman word meaning "listen." Afterwards, they would nail the official document to the doorpost for the benefit of the reading folk. The subjects announced usually relating to the royal courts or public authorities, bylaws, tax rises, ceremonies, fetes, and local events. A surprising number of common phrases derive from town criers. The expression "posting a notice" began the naming of newspapers as "the post." "Don't shoot the messenger" was a warning that as royal representatives, they were all protected by law. Even now, they must not be hindered or heckled during their duties, and officially an act of treason for anyone that causes them harm. The hourly status call, such as 10 o'clock and all is well, stemmed from their other public duties in the past, when acting as peacekeepers patrolling the streets after dark. Not dissimilar to a neighbourhood watch these days. In the UK, there are two official guilds, the Ancient and Honourable Guild of Town Criers and the Loyal Company of Town Criers, who register both men and women criers. There are friendly competitions too, where along with the usual placements of first, second and third, entrants can win Best Dressed, Best Couple and Best Ambassador awards. Some prestigious trophies attract international town crier competitors as well. All these speakers, be it socially conscious citizens, podcasters, toastmasters, or town criers, are helping to widen the reach and diversity of speeches to engage people in modern day issues. May you always find the right words for every occasion.
TNF Soundings.
Albion match report. Struggling West Bromwich Albion hammered 10-man Hull City to claim their first win since the 29th of December and move out of the Championship relegation zone. The Baggies took the lead against their promotion-chasing visitors when Josh Madger finished from Jed Wallace's ball across the box. Hull went down to 10 men when defender Charlie Hughes was sent off for what the referee adjudged to be a last-man foul on Wallace. The dominant hosts doubled their advantage after the break when Orne Hegbo converted at the near post. Callum Stiles saw a thumping shot come back off the post as Albion pushed for a third, and it came in time added on when Isaac Price coolly slotted in to end their 13-match wait for a league win in style. Victory for James Morrison's men moved them up to 21st in the Championship, 1 point above Oxford United with 8 games to play. Hull City, who created next to nothing all afternoon, remained 5th. West Brom's most comprehensive win of the season came on an afternoon where they outshot their visitors by 26-8. The Baggies had looked set to end their long wait for a win on Wednesday night, only for a last-minute equaliser from Kyle Larin for Southampton to consign them to yet more disappointment. However, they did not seem to suffer any effects from that, and Hull goalkeeper Ivor Pandor was forced into a strong early save by the lively Danny Imrie. Pandor was then at fault for West Brom's first goal, as his kick-out was intercepted on halfway and Wallace raced down the right before teeing up Madger for a first league goal since October. Wallace was central to the game's next key moment too, as he pinched the ball off Hughes 20 yards out on the angle of the area, and referee Josh Smith sent off the ex-Wigan man for pulling back Wallace as he looked to break into the area. City's misery continued when they were forced into a change before the break as skipper Louis Coyle went off injured. Aston Villa loanee Jamaldeen Jamoah Aloba teed up Hegbo for his first goal since the 12th of December, and Northern Ireland international Price ensured the scoreline matched the home team's dominance in stoppage time from Imre's ball. West Brom, who are now unbeaten in 3, visit mid-table Bristol City next Saturday, while Sergej Jarovic's Tigers host relegated Sheffield Wednesday on the same afternoon. James Morrison said, "It's been coming. The lads were fantastic, full of energy and hungry. In my head, I thought it might be a bit cagey and scrappy, but the lads showed what they were capable of. The sending off came from us causing their backline problems. I've got to give credit to the whole team. Everyone did their job today, and long may it continue. It's only a start. I'll enjoy this tonight, because it's been a long time coming, and I'll get right back onto them."
A few weeks ago, I spoke with Sophia, who came over to West Bromwich all the way from Dudley, to talk to us about an eye condition she has, neurological eye disorder. It's very hard to diagnose, and this isn't meant to be in any way a factual description or definition of what it is, more about how it affects her life.
Hi, I'm Sophia, and I'm here today to talk about functional neurological disorder or functional vision disorder.
I believe there sometimes are other terms for it. The internet tells me it can be called visual loss disorder or neurological visual loss. So could you explain that a bit more, because I understand it. If you were to examine the eye, it might appear to be working perfectly, but with neurological disorder, there's more to it.
With functional neurological disorder or functional vision disorder, the eye can appear to be, like you say, perfectly fine. And the brain itself can also appear to be fine. But it's actually an issue with the signals between your brain and your eyes. So for me, specifically, it's a miscommunication between my eyes and my brain. So I was kind of diagnosed when I was a teenager. I basically developed peripheral field loss, and it was quite fairly severe, and basically it kind of just must have developed when I was like an early teenager, and they only really found it out sort of later on when I was actually getting diagnosed, well, getting support from a VI team that had come into the school. And they were going, can you see the ball at the side of your face? Can you see the ball? And I was like, no, I'm not seeing it. Like, I'm telling you when I'm seeing it. And they were like, but can't you see it when it comes next to your face? I was like, no, like, I'm telling you when I'm seeing it. So, of course, that kind of then started the investigation into what it was. And eventually, after quite a long process, we found out that this is what it is. Today, my eyesight has settled down quite a bit from what it was, but as it is a condition that can have aspects to it, such as stress can affect it, and you know, psychological stress, anything like that can affect it quite heavily. I do still get periods where my eyesight can be impacted by FND or FVD. And as I understand it, you can kind of heal from it, but for me it is kind of like always sort of there, because I think it is the way my brain has learnt to deal with things. Instead of maybe, I don't know, shutting down in a different way, it does shut down that visual processing side of my brain. And I think maybe that is like, I think as a condition, it's the pathway that the brain has learnt to deal with like difficult situations. In my instance, I know some people have the condition and they don't have a psychological aspect to it, but for me personally, I think that is a huge aspect of the condition.
You mentioned earlier the getting used to see a ball moving into your field of vision. It almost suggests something a bit like tunnel vision, but it isn't, of course. But that might affect you in sports activities, for example, I would imagine.
100%.
Yeah.
So,
are there any other areas where it affects you? But yeah, talk about sport if you like, but other things as well does it affect?
Well, at the time when I kind of was diagnosed, it did really affect me, like in, like you say, with sports, PE. Actually, this was kind of what led to me having my peripheral fields tested, because I just basically just kept getting hit in the face in like sports and everything. And so I'd play like basketball in PE and I just kept getting like hit in the face by other people or hit in the face with the ball. And they were like, but you didn't move out of the way? Like, did you not see that? And I'm like, no. Today, my vision, like I say, is more stable, but on when there is periods where my peripheral vision is more affected, I do have issues with, you know, walking into things or kind of struggling in crowds. That's still something that affects me.
So, like, if you're on a busy railway station, for example?
Definitely, yeah, because there's a lot of visual information, and because it is something that I feel is highly linked to that kind of visual processing element. When there's a lot of visual information in a crowd, it can be quite distressing, which again links to that kind of trigger.
I suppose it's not easy to imagine if you get stressed out, it can become more pronounced.
Yeah, and one thing that I did find out via research is, for example, in situations where you are more focused on the condition, for example, in doctor's appointments or things like that, the condition can actually become more pronounced. Apparently, it's not unusual, like, when people get diagnosed in doctor's offices, things like that, the condition can be a lot more severe than in other...
About other activities, like reading or things that you need to do at home in the kitchen, example?
Well, for me, I often require large print. That's not just because of functional neurological disorder, but it's also because I also have a condition called Erlen syndrome, which means words can move on the page and things like that. But one aspect of the condition is fatigue. This is the functional neurological disorder. So when I was in school, college, etc., I'd have to have large print because I can read it, but that accumulative stress makes it more difficult for me to access it over time. And it's hard to describe it because you might think, oh, but you can read that. And yet, at times I can read that. But when that's that accumulative kind of wear and focus, it just makes it more difficult over time.
So when it came to diagnosis, was that down to an ophthalmist or did it involve more people?
I think there was a few people kind of involved in my diagnosis, but finally it came down to an ophthalmologist who luckily had met someone else who had the condition, but like you said, it was basically very rare. They didn't really know. I didn't know at the time whether I'd actually ever meet anyone who had it. And so I think my personal opinion is that it is rare to be diagnosed, but I don't think it is a rare condition. Because my personal thoughts on it are, although I have one aspect of this, which is peripheral vision, there's lots of other things, like people have double vision or they have blurred vision that comes on and off. There's lots of kind of other visual disturbances that people can have that they might not know is linked to this condition and the way the brain processes images.
So there's really an element of it to do with visual processing in the visual cortex, I suppose. Not that I'm a psychologist, but it's really beyond the eye, at the back of the eye, what goes on as much as the eye itself. Or instead of the eye itself, is perhaps what you're saying?
I think so. I think with the research that there is, it's not clear yet exactly what causes it. The theory is that it is that signalling issue between the brain and the eye, like you say, and how the brain processes images.
Well, it does occur to me that the condition being so difficult to diagnose, what sort of issues, if any, have you had when it comes to the situation with benefits?
I think in terms of that, there's very little support for people. There are, because the condition is quite widespread, so for example, with functional neurological disorder, some people have seizures and some people have restless leg type kind of symptoms. There's lots of a variety of symptoms, but it is more difficult when you have, say, a separate shoot off this condition like functional vision disorder, to get that support. Even in, I'm coming at it from an educational perspective, even when you're trying to get like educational support, trying to get people to understand what it is, why you need support, and the fact that it is a dynamic disability that changes and fluctuates is difficult to get people to understand, let alone within the benefit system.
What sort of support is there around for functional visual disorder?
At the moment, I have been speaking with a charity called FND Hope, but I believe that mostly the charity focuses on those with seizures or other aspects of the condition.
This is a UK-based charity.
It's international. So there is a wide kind of... There's some bases in America, Australia. I think there's a large community there. And there is some support in the UK. And so there is some support with that. But on a whole, I don't think people realise that this can be like a separate aspect of the condition. I think there's that focus on functional neurological disorder and kind of the seizure aspect of it and things like that. And of course that's very important and I want to get that out there as well, but I think those who have just the vision, I don't really know many people who have just the vision. In fact, none at all. Most people have the accumulation of symptoms, including seizures.
Do you come across any situations about difficulties with people's attitude towards it?
100%. I think this is why I'm so passionate about talking about it, because people don't understand what it is, and they don't understand that it is a real condition, that you're not in control of the symptoms that happen to you, that the symptoms can change, and that, like I say, it's a dynamic disability, you know. And the thing with functional neurological disorder is, because it's such a wide spectrum, you know, there are some people whose mobility is vastly affected by the condition, or they have, like I say, like non-epileptic seizures. I don't have that, but because it's such a widespread condition, people, I don't think, understand all the aspects of it. So even me, who has this condition, I don't understand all the time whether I have other aspects of it, because there's just so much kind of out there. I'd like to talk a little bit about how someone who might be listening to this might know someone or maybe has this condition, but doesn't know. I'd like to say, you know, if you think maybe this is something that is affecting you, maybe you have double vision or blurred vision, or peripheral vision loss, and you don't know, you've been told, oh, but there's no organic cause for it, to get it out there that this exists and that it is real. So if you want to find out more about it, I would recommend the website for the FND charity, FND Hope. And I believe there are a few websites out there, such as FND Awareness.
And thank you to Sophia for sharing that information and her experiences with us. That interview happened a few weeks ago, and I'm only sorry I didn't include it before now, but I'll be including a bit more from Sophia in next week's edition, because she's working on another project with the Beacon Centre about the experiences and oral history of life with visual impairment, a project that SVI have been aiming to continue doing, because we've done one or two things about it in the past. It should be interesting, and there's an invitation for you to get involved in that. So that's something to listen out for next week. In the meantime, a final piece from Talking News Federation.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
This is Alastair Hutton with an article by Heather. This year's death of Lady Jean Wilson at the age of 103 marks the end of her personal 75-year commitment to fighting sight loss. However, her work will continue through the Sight Savers charity that she co-founded with her late husband, a charity that has helped millions of people across the world. Lady Jean Wilson and her husband, Sir John Wilson, founded the charity back in 1950. In reality, though, the journey to creating the charity had begun almost 20 years earlier, in 1931, when the 12-year-old John was blinded in a school chemistry lesson accident. John adapted to living without sight and referred to his blindness as nothing more than a confounded nuisance. After a law degree at Oxford University, John's first job was assistant secretary at the National Institute for the Blind. However, he felt the organisation had old-fashioned attitudes, focusing simply on sheltered workshop projects where blind people made baskets and brooms. During the Second World War, John realised that factories were short of workers, so he set out on visits to establish what work could be carried out by blind people. By the end of the war, more than 3,000 visually impaired people were working in factories alongside sighted people and earning a proper wage. In 1944, Jean and John married, and a couple of years later, he embarked on a tour of Africa and the Middle East, visiting what was then the British Empire. He was shocked at the scale of blindness he encountered and returned home determined to do something about it. But his bosses at the National Institute for the Blind said it was outside the organisation's remit. It was then that Jean and John decided to create a new organisation to tackle the problem. In January 1950, they founded what was then called the British Empire Society for the Blind to help advance the rights of blind people and remove the stigma of being blind in Africa. The charity was later renamed Sight Savers. The new charity set out to achieve its aims through social inclusion, training and education, bringing together John's experience of blindness and Jean's training as a teacher. One of the charity's first projects in Africa involved farm training centres set up by John and Jean in the 1950s to teach blind men how to farm a small plot of land. This training enabled the men to provide for themselves and their families while gaining dignity, independence and respect in their village communities. Jean's experience as a teacher was instrumental in the charity's work to found schools for the blind and disabled children. Jean used her teaching knowledge to study the American approach to integrated schooling before she and John started their first integrated education project, offering places to blind and disabled children in Uganda. In the early days of the charity in the 1950s, work started in Kenya, Uganda, Ghana, Malawi, Zimbabwe, and Nigeria, with several other African countries following in the next two decades. In the 1960s and 70s, Sight Savers expanded into Asia, with projects in India, Pakistan and Bangladesh, and continued to extend its work across Africa. John was knighted in 1975. John and Jean continued to campaign together for the cure and prevention of blindness until John's death in 1999. After his death, Jean continued her advocacy work with Sight Savers and remained a vice president of the charity until she herself died in 2026. Now, more than 75 years on from their first projects, and thanks to John Jean's vision, the charity works in 33 countries across Africa and Asia. Since it began in 1950, Sight Savers has had a huge impact. For example, it has carried out 9.7 million cataract operations, trained 380,000 people with disabilities to help them earn a living, and distributed 1.8 billion treatments to prevent debilitating diseases. This is all thanks to the vision created by a young couple in the 1950s. Today, Sight Savers' three priorities are protecting sight, fighting disease, and disability rights. If you want to find out more, you can visit the charity's website at www.sightsavers.org. And if fighting sight loss and disability discrimination was not enough, Jean and John also went on to found other organisations to support people with a range of disabilities. These organisations include the Impact Foundation, which aims to prevent disabilities caused by disease or lack of medical services, the Hearing Conservation Council, and the International Agency for the Prevention of Blindness.
TNS Soundings.
Thank you to all our Sandwell volunteers who've read the Express and Star articles for us. They were Mia, Jan, Gavin, Linda, Janet and Trevor. Thanks to Sue for picking all the articles that everyone's read. Thanks to Sarah Ann also for the quiz. And a big thank you to Alison for covering sending out the articles to everyone whilst I was away over the weekend. Thanks to Ray for putting it all together. And, of course, to Tony and Gavin for putting everything onto the USB sticks and CDs and sending them out in the post to you. Well, nice to see some sunshine today. Let's hope it lasts into next week or this week. Have a lovely week, everybody.
And I am very grateful to Pam and Alison for sorting out the readings, getting them all over to me for this week. Both are very efficient ladies. And talking of thank yous, we must belatedly thank all the people who very kindly contributed to Talking News funds over Christmas with our Christmas appeal. A big thank you to all of them, the regular ones as well, who faithfully year after year send us a generous donation, but to everybody else who sent in a donation, it's nice to know we're appreciated in that way. As Pam says, spring has sprung, at least for this week. I think I might have been a bit optimistic with the forecast for next week. It might be a little bit cooler, but all the same, I think we are definitely moving into spring. I believe in a week's time or so, I've yet to look up exactly when we put the clocks forward, but it's about that time. And there'll be a reminder of that before we take our break next week, which I'm afraid we have to do, as much because of the postal situation of getting the news to our postal listeners on time, but also because many of our readers have other commitments, family commitments, which prevent them from getting their readings to us on time for our deadline, which is usually late on Wednesday before you hear this edition. So we will be back with you next week, but we'll be off for a fortnight after that. Hope you won't miss us too much. I hope I might see some of you at next week's meeting at SVI, which is going to be a very important one because of our funding situation. So I hope to see many of you next week. But in the meantime, it's bye-bye from me, Ray, and all the team for this week. And we'll be back for the final edition before Easter next week. Bye-bye for now.
To use our talk phone service to listen to Sandwell Talking News or leave us a message, phone 0121 699 6696. If you are using a landline in the 0121 area, then just dial 699 6696.